Over the last 2 weeks, we have been discussing Christian character. We've been discussing it as it has been set out in the Beatitudes. The first Beatitudes we were saying went especially talked about our relationship to God, the other four very much more, not either exclusively more about our relationship to the rest of the world. So they painted a comprehensive portrait of what believers should be, members of the kingdom, followers of Jesus. Whichever term you like works very well. So, it's a pretty daunting image. And what comes back to me is it's only possible because of the Holy Spirit enabling us, and if we began it with the first beatitude, empty vessels on our knees before a righteous God, recognizing that we don't have it. And then we can build from there. That is the essential beginning place. So, after this Christian character, that's great. So now, what will the influence of those followers of Jesus be on the world around us? What kind of influence should we have, should we expect to have? You know, if you're like me, you'd rather just move off to the monastery, apart from the vows of silence and celibacy and some things like that. That sounds good. We could all find a small area around here, close maybe, and buy six houses there. Or if there are more of us, we could go and say, we'll take over Woodgate or someplace like that and say, we'll be there, we'll live there. We can share lawnmowers and we can share washing machines, and that's a great economy and very unworldly and a good thing. The problem is, although that may be valuable and there's a place and time for that, we can't stay in the enclave. We can't stay in the ghetto, if I may use the word. The kind of character that we've been discussing, if it is formed in us, will insist that we go out and share what we have with the rest of the world. It's not something we can keep to ourselves. The problem is, we look at that character, and the world would say, well, you've talked about being meek, and you've talked about being peacemakers and mercy. You think those people are going to have an influence? Surely not. In fact, we believe we will have a strong influence, and that's the position of Jesus. He considered those followers that he had just described the character of would be the people who would have a strong influence on the world. So we need to look in those terms too. Now, I encourage you, we've just read this. Would you like to open your Bibles, have them there, have them available so you can look down and refer and make sure I'm not leading you astray? This is an important part of being people of the Word. Matthew 5. I am going to read it again. We don't get tired of this. As a child, I certainly did. I hated when they sang all four verses. I just wanted the first, second, and fourth. And now I hate it when they skip the third. Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its lampstand, on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. There is a major underlying assertion I'd like to start with right at the beginning. It needs to be spoken, it's implicit, it needs to be explicit, we need to not miss it. And that is that the two communities, the world, or the earth, and the believers, will be distinct. They will be different. They will not be homogenous. Yes, there's a relationship. We are indeed living in the world, we are part of the peoples, and we are of them, but there is a distinction which must be there. The followers Jesus is speaking of at that time, the Bible says it was his followers or disciples. So it's not just the apostles. Don't make that mistake. Those people who are following him. He said, this is the way you'll be if you follow, if you're in my kingdom. And he's saying this is the influence you will have. Surely that transfers without difficulty or violence to us as followers or to the church today. So he's talking about us as followers, and he's saying what we should do. We will have to be different, or we will not be effective in what we're doing. We will come back to that theme. So the first assertion is very, very simple and clear. the two communities will be distinct and will be true to themselves. And the world, in being true to itself, will tend toward decay. It will tend toward decay, and the salt is there to hinder the decay. Yes, salt is used to make food savory, but even more, in a pre-refrigeration world, salt, or vinegar sometimes, is there to keep food from rotting. It preserves it. Now, try and imagine, are we trying to salt the world to make it savory so God can stand it? It's tasty. No, we're not making the world tasty. We're preserving it from rot and from the tendency to decay. There are other restraining influences in the world that God has given us. The first restraining influence is going to be the family. In marriage and the family and a good and healthy and wholesome family relationship, there will be restraint from selfishness and evil desires and tendencies. That's the way a family works. The love we learn as parents, if you've experienced it, make a change and a difference in our lives. We, in turn, try to make a change and difference in our children's lives. The other major influence in the world, of course, is the state. The state has the power to enact and enforce laws. It doesn't matter. Sometimes they're bad laws. Sometimes it's despotic. But overall, there are laws, and they restrain men from going whichever way they want to so they can live together in peace with less harm and less violence when the state is working the way it should. And the third influence that Jesus intends is the church. These people that we sometimes think might just be so meek they wouldn't say boo to a ghost or whatever are to be the third major disinfectant in the world. Those people, the peacemakers and the righteous, will be the disinfectant of the world. They will be tending to regenerate the world from standards that are low, standards that are changing all the time, or maybe standards that are just absent. And we can see examples of in places like that. Now, strictly speaking, salt can't lose its saltiness. You've all heard sermons about how, well, back in the day, the salt was impure, and if it got leached out by water, it wasn't salty, and it just becomes a white powder. And you know what? I've never heard a historical background for that really stood up. I'm trying to make the whole metaphor and Jesus' extension of losing saltiness palatable. In fact, I don't think we need to go there. The metaphor is clear. If salt isn't salty, it's not doing its job. We don't have to say, well, it was impure. Maybe this is what happened. Maybe then they would throw it out on the road. No, the metaphor stands up fine. 2 years ago, about 2 years, Sally, we were in the Holy Land and at the Dead Sea, a lifelong dream. I remember as a 6 or 7 year old seeing pictures of people floating on the Dead Sea on their backs holding a newspaper because you pop up like a cork. It's so thick, it's like mud. It's amazing. You've seen the pictures and it really is like that. But more than that, that isn't just salt. If you and I are swimming in Florida and get some salt water in our mouth, it's no big deal. It's kind of savory. We've got a suntan and we're a little bit thirsty, and swallowing a little is no big deal. If you get some of the Dead Sea in your mouth, you are spitting for a long time. It is nasty. It tastes corrosive and abrasive, and it's really horrible. James Gray fell backwards, or tripped, fell back, because they're nodules underneath made of salt. So he was stepping backwards, tripped, and got some up his nose and his mouth. He was miserable. And he had the equivalent of a sinus infection for days because it was costing enough to sort of sear the inside of his nasal passages. The stuff is terrible. I really can't imagine that kind of stuff, or natron that you use to preserve the mummies with, would be okay salt, and that could be leached out and not be good. I don't go there. In fact, the other discussion is, well, salt could have had impurities in it, and then it becomes, in fact, it can become poisonous. That's true. And we as Christians and believers, if we have impurities, may, in fact, become toxic for the world. Again, we may be extending the metaphor Jesus is using, which is a very simple metaphor. You are the salt, and if you aren't salty, what good are you? That's where we want to go. The issue is, if we're not salty, we are indistinguishable from the rest of the world. Throw it out on the ground, let people walk on it. The second metaphor is the metaphor of light. You are the light of the world. kind of obvious. It's no use if it's hidden. If you put it under a bushel, no, I'm going to let it shine. Or if you hide the light, even I happen to be sleeping in a dark room in the basement right now. I know that if I put a night light down there to give a little light at night, but put it behind the table, it's not going to give enough night light to shine and give a little light in the darkness. It's got to be somewhere where the light can get out. That's simple. We understand that. It's a very simple metaphor. Now, here's what is interesting, though. What is our light? If you've got your Bible open, look on down there and see what he says. What is your light? Let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds. It's very interesting. It's about our good deeds, or sometimes it's translated good works. It's not how nice we are, how polite we are, how sweet we are. It's not how well we worship and whether we're always faithful or whether we wear the right clothes. It's none of the things that we often set store by. It's about our good works. I'm glad Jesus was specific, because we could have cottoned on to a whole lot of other things and gone with him. And here's another wonderful step. The glory goes to God, not to me, not to you. If what we need is light, we do not praise the lamp. There's a time to praise lamps. We're talking about the art. It's a beautiful lamp. No, no, no. If you're talking about light in darkness, you praise the light, not the lamp, not the candle, but the light. And we are showing the light of Jesus, and he gets the glory. God gets the glory. And that's very interesting and very specific and clear. We're transmitting his light. So here we go. Obviously, next question. What are the good works supposed to be? This is marvelous. I'm ready to lay it on and give it to you concrete so you can take it home on Monday and do it. James, for example, 1:27 says, this is true religion, that you should care for the widow and orphan. So we understand it's a real hands-on, hands-feet thing. It's not an ivory tower thing. Very simple. And I could give you such a list, and you know what you'd do? If you're like me, you'd be sitting there saying, well, that's not me. I'm excused from that one because I don't have a neighbor like that. I'm excused from that one because my job really keeps me from doing that. And pretty soon, anything I can specifically name is going to be gone for you. You will have excused yourself perfectly. I would have. I'm not getting on your case. I would have excused myself. I've done it all my life, sitting right where you're sitting. So what we need to be doing is asking God, what are the things I should be doing? Yes, I should be working for justice. Yes, I should be being honest and living a life of integrity, but there's probably more, and we need to be asking God and seeking his face as to what it is. You remember Mother Teresa? None of the things she did was more than, in fact, a simple act of kindness. Famous woman. And if you look at it, she went out on the street, found a beggar or a man dying in the gutter, and took him to where he could be cared for while he was dying. Probably still died most of the time. But remember this quote she said, I'm coming back to make sure I get it right. Not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And I think if you want one to take home today, there it is. God, what small things do you want me to be doing? Help me do them with great love. And Lynn's not going to give you a list this morning, although you're going to hear later on the kind of things we need to be aware of and not make a mistake about. Okay. There's also discussion that the good work should be evangelism. I'm all before evangelism. Martin Luther thought that the entire meaning here, the whole message, was it's about evangelism. I'm not sure. I don't think so, and here's why. If we are seen by the world, in our world today, in the context of evangelism, most of the world is going to see us as trying to win converts for our cause, the Christian jihad or the Christian right or whatever. We understand we are trying to draw people to Jesus for freedom, for salvation, to live forever, to change their lives and change them for generations. As they change and change things happening in their homes, the lives of their children will be changing. We've seen it, and we know it happens. But the world doesn't see that. They just think we're getting converts to our cause. But when we go down to Katrina and do relief, helping people get back into their homes, when we do things to feed the hungry, when we give backpacks and school supplies to the needy, they see that. That's very hands-on. And that also wins us the right, the audience, to speak and say, we do this because of Jesus. We think there's freedom in Jesus, and we'd like to tell you about him. And if we're just going out and doing evangelism without that, I actually don't think it's going to shine the light as Jesus is talking about. I think that's why he says good works. He doesn't say preach the word. It's very interesting. He could be more clear. What was it St. Francis said? St. Francis said, preach the word always. If necessary, use words. That's so good, so profound. Preach the word always. If necessary, or sometimes, use words. Okay, now, what lessons can we draw from this? I'd like to draw three lessons. This is old hat. You've known this since you were a child, all right? So far. Here are the three lessons I'd like to draw from it. First of all, there must remain a fundamental difference between the church and the world. We simply cannot fulfill our mission to the world if basically we are like the world. We will fail. We will have no influence. Dressing like the Amish, no buttons. No, is it buttons and no zippers? Wearing long tassels on our robes, wearing ringlets in our hair, wearing long skirts, never wearing trousers. There's so many things we can do that will mark us as different. But it's not those external markers or the boundary markers. You can see the boundaries. But it's the internal differences in our hearts and the way we act and the way we live, the integrity we live with, the love we show to other people. And if we do not have those differences, we will not have the influence Jesus wants in the world. There won't be a difference. It won't be happening. We may think it is, and we may fool ourselves for a while, but it's not going to happen. And that begins, I sincerely believe, with the believer on his knees before God. I don't have anything to offer except what you give me. And then we grow from there in meekness, in mercy, in peacekeeping. Okay. It is disturbing when we look at the church in our era, never mind historically, and see how like the world we are. Historically, it's a problem. The church has bought into whatever was going on. It's the great tragedy of the church that it has been conformed to whatever was going on in the world rather than transformed from it. So getting behind the politics of the time, getting behind the king. I'm not saying we shouldn't support the king, but all the king's policies are not right. And often the church has just gotten behind the king, gotten behind the crusades, gotten behind the oppression of various peoples. And in our day, we can look at ourselves and see this. We see that our children are not better. My children aren't. I love my children, but I'm not putting them on a pedestal. Or we see that statistically there's just as much divorce in the church as outside of the church. Now, please, I'm not casting stones here. If you know me at all, you know that I was divorced 35 years ago, and I still bear some of that. God's grace has covered most of that. But it's there. The point is, I'm not casting stones. I'm saying, why in our community have we not formed characters that let us be different and maintain a difference and a distinction from the world? And I think we failed at character. We've tried to do some actions instead of forming a character from which the actions will follow. The tragedy of the church is that it has often conformed. We do not serve God well if we've conformed to the world. We do not serve the world well. We do not serve ourselves well. Go back to it. If we have conformed to the world, we will not serve the world and help to transform the world. Second point. We must accept the responsibility that a distinction places upon us. It's interesting, in the Greek, the word, when Jesus says, you are the light of the world, he's using an emphatic pronoun. It's as if he's saying, you and only you. Very emphatic. You and only you are the light of the world. You and only you are the salt. And the implication is, if you don't do it, nobody else will. We need to step up to the plate. Oh, I got in a sports metaphor. Yes. my weak area, humor and sports metaphors. We need to step up to the plate because the implication is others will not. If you are frustrated with the world, there's something we can do. If you're not frustrated with the world, then you're not paying attention. If you do not see the structures of pain or causing pain and causing suffering in the world, you're missing out on the news. And a lot of us hide from the news. We're not hearing a lot about white sex traffic, slave traffic in the world. We're not hearing how much abuse there is in homes. It's there, and we need to be aware. We need to be deeply concerned, and we should be frustrated. Now, once we feel frustrated, we don't throw up our hands. There's nothing we can do, because in fact, we are empowered by God, and we can make a difference. And we are called to be revolutionaries. I'm not real comfortable with that. I really just want to be a nice guy and let things get on and get on with my life, but that's not what I'm called to. I'm called not just to be a needle on people, but to speak the truth in love and to speak it clearly. We're not helpless. We're not powerless. We're called to be radicals and revolutionaries. So, you may need to be asking where you should be doing that. It may not be at the United Nations, but I guarantee on your street, in that close that you didn't just have Christian neighbors, there is opportunity. And we need to be watching for that instead of watching the reruns. I'm there. I'm not throwing stones that are not my own stones. Okay, third. We need to see our responsibility as a twofold responsibility. Now let me unpack that a bit. Salt and light both go out and give of themselves in a sense. You use the salt. It doesn't come back in the packet. You don't get the light and you put it back in the candle. It goes out. So it's not self-preserving. It is not self-protective. That is the very opposite of some religiosity, which is back to me. I didn't get much out of this service this week. What are we bringing and what are we giving of ourselves rather than looking to receive? We are going to receive. If you've been down this road, if you tried going beyond tithing, you know you were blessed way past. You may not have been blessed with dollars, but you were blessed way past. One of the most bizarre paradoxes for me is that simple truth that God will not be outgiven. It doesn't work for me because I know you're not supposed to test God. But it works because, in fact, He will not be outgiven. The more we give of ourselves, the more we receive. Not many of you, but some of you will remember Rocky and Debbie Scott. They were astonishing Christian people, and they gave themselves. I didn't know until after Rocky's death how much they'd given, how many people they were blessing, spending so much time with other people, but they always had it to give. When we were with them, they acted like we were their best friends, and they just had all the time in the world. I had no idea that other evenings they were doing the same thing with other people. And they were a couple with joy and love in their hearts. They were a nice example, and others you know, where the more they gave, the more they received, and the more they were filled. We tend to go out in the world with its sliding standards and feel that we're there to help the people who are battered and bruised and broken by the world. Yes, but we are also called to have influence on and speak against those structures that are causing the battering and the bruising. That's being salt. We're not absolved. We don't throw up our hands and say, well, we're powerless. We'll just help band-aid the people who come out of the wrecks. We need to be at the street corner saying, dangerous curve, slow down to the culture and to our neighbors. That, I think, is our being salt. We're not here to be the sugar of the world and to sweeten it up. That's what I want to do. I just want everybody to like me. I just want to be the sugar of the world. And it doesn't work that way. We're here to stop the rot. We also need to be more than signposts saying, degenerate, keep away. We need to be part of the regeneration of the world. And that's where we're shining the light of truth, the light of Jesus, to help regenerate and rebuild a broken world. So we're stopping the rot, and we're also wanting to rebuild and make it better. And that is through showing our actions will be the light that will draw men to God. Now, it may be that the salt and light is parallels the two sides of our concern, the social side, to be salt. We have a social responsibility. We need to be out there helping people. And the evangelical concern, the need to speak the truth, to draw people to Jesus. We have a social concern, soup kitchens. We have an evangelical concern, preach the word. And this has always been a tension in the church. Some people are very, very comfortable just with being in a soup kitchen, and churches just do that and don't preach the word. And we have others where they just preach the word, but they never do anything to help people who are hungry. We are called to be doing both, and that's the twofold mission of our calling. Jesus is ultimately the light. No matter how many band-aids we put on, we're not going to really stop the need to be bandaging people until we bring people and structures into line with the truth of Jesus. So the influence we will wield depends on our character. I'm going back to the beginning, where Jesus started with the Beatitudes in this long teaching that goes on for chapters. It starts with our character. The Beatitudes set a very high standard. But they're really good incentives. Everybody loves incentives. That's what we talk about these days. Let's incentivize. Good incentives. We will be blessed. There's no real blessing without goodness. We will be blessed as we do this. The world will be blessed. How brilliant is that? We can bring a blessing to the world. Broken as it is, we can help. And third, God will be praised. The character that was formed in us as we fell on our knees before the living God and accepted His grace will be thrilled with that. That's not a worldly appreciation. Yeah, well, we should be happy because God's getting praised. As believers, yes, we believe in an almighty Creator God who loves us, who should be praised, who's worthy of praise, and to see more praise go to Him is good and worthy, and we're happy about it.